This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, thanks very much for downloading this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, and obviously it's coming into winter, and that means that the species changes, and we start to think about darkness and light and everything else, and this is what we're getting up to this week. I've got a complaint. Well, an observation. No, it is actually a complaint. It is definitely a complaint. It's been a bit chilly over the last few mornings, so today I am trialling thermal drawers, basically, thermal underwear. But they're for skiers. Now, in the old days, these things are figure-hugging, right? Which is not necessarily a good thing. Trust me. But in the old days, thermal gear was kind of baggy. You know, you could carry some shopping home in it, that kind of thing. This is just too tight. I actually feel colder than if I'm not wearing it. This is weird. Good morning. I'm Mark Stephen, live from the BBC Aberdeen car park. Joining me in the depths of darkness in Hampshire is Mr. Ewan McElrafe.
With, frankly, astonishment that as the nation slowly pulls itself together, you paint this picture, which, frankly, most people would rather not.
Now, get that out of your head. Yes.
Today is a fantastic morning here. Not a cloud in the sky. Orion's Belt just slipping slowly over the horizon. I can see Venus really clearly. I've got Cassiopeia, the pole star. A great sky for seeing shooting stars.
Don't talk to me about it. Don't talk to me. Earlier this week, I was up at 3:30 in the morning, as per your recommendation, coming into Tuesday morning. Ask me how many I saw. Go on, just ask me.
None. One less than me, I think. Yeah, I saw one.
You told me two earlier.
So
you were obviously lying.
Apologies to everybody.
Yeah, never mind. First touch of snow or sleet this week for some in the neck of the woods. It's just that time of year when, frankly, you've got no idea what the weather's going to hold for you. But embrace it. We must.
Yeah, as usual, we've plenty of ideas of places to go and things to do, and look out from your doorstep and beyond. Let us know if you've got outdoor plans this weekend. Our email address is outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. You can text 80295. You can call as well. Sam's taking your calls this morning. 08 085 92 95 00. And we've got the Radio Scotland Facebook page as well.
Coming up, we've got the award-winning singer-songwriter whose latest album takes its inspiration from Nan Shepherd and a great work, The Living Mountain. We'll be looking at the tree known as the Wayfarer Tree, and of course we've got a mystery bird. What, just out of curiosity, what degree of difficulty are you going for this week?
Well, I went for 10 last week and the nation got it right, so what do we know? I'm thinking about 7 out of 10, but listeners are always proving her wrong. Here's your first wee blast of this bird. No clues yet, but it's not the one that probably springs to mind first. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or give Sam a call on 08 085 92 95 00.
Now, man sells company to invest in Highland Estate doesn't exactly sound like a groundbreaking headline. But Jeremy Leggett is not just any man, and he's hoping that Bunloit Estate will be not just any other estate. The social entrepreneur and writer has got a background in solar energy, and he's also a climate campaigner with Greenpeace. Here he is showing a landlord colleague, Fiona Clark, around Bunloit.
Well, we're on the slopes of Loch Ness, looking down on the loch and across beautiful mixed woodland of Bunloit. Birch woods, oak woods, plus pasture, and it's very varied terrain in quite a small area, 511 hectares, and already soaking up a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and pretty biodiverse. But my dream is to turn this into a real exemplar of a carbon sink, sucking down increasing amounts of carbon dioxide into the woods, into the peatlands, and into a limited, very small number of wooden eco homes on the estate, so that the whole thing is a holistic carbon sink and the biodiversity is growing as well. That's my aspiration.
And why choose here?
This is, I think, a particularly interesting terrain because there's so many habitats in such a relatively short, small area. That's what fascinated me about it. And there's also an opportunity, I think, we're quite close to a community down in the village of Drumna Drocket. So very much part of my vision is to make a project like this community-centred. I'm hoping to create as many green outdoor jobs as I can, a sort of exemplar for the rural version of the Green New Deal. And so being close to a community is also an important part of what I'm hoping to do.
Why? Why do you want to include the community in this process?
Because people are part of the environment and we will never beat the enormous threat. I'm essentially a climate campaigner. I have been for two decades and that's what motivates me. And we'll never beat this horrendous threat of climate change unless we can involve pretty much everybody in the fight. And that's why community is so important.
What's the ultimate vision? What would you like to see develop here?
In 5 years' time, I'm hoping it'll be, you know, a pretty well-known project, inspiring a lot of people, not just in Scotland, but internationally, with what it's done in carbon sequestration. So it will be intensely monitored. We will be able to prove everything, all the numbers, which so many people can't do in the climate debate at the moment. And I'm really looking forward, for example, to working with Scottish universities who've already been in touch about bringing the most modern equipment out to measure the carbon so we can establish a baseline of how much is being sucked down from the atmosphere and then also measure the improvements we make as we rewild the woodlands, as we manage some of the woodlands and as we restore the peatlands.
Traditionally, I suppose, Highland estates would be seen as somewhere where hunting, shooting, fishing took place. Do you think there's a new breed of landowner coming in that has a very different vision?
I don't know yet enough of the landowners to have a considered opinion on that. I mean, I certainly would view myself as somewhat different from what I hear the average estate owner is in Scotland. I don't hunt, I don't shoot. I might be tempted to go fishing occasionally. And I certainly am not interested in inviting parties of rich English hedge funders up to charge them vast sums of money to, you know, shoot grouse and do all the things that traditionally get done in the old failed model of how to run an estate.
Some people would say that word failed is particularly controversial. Do you think there will be pushback against your model?
Of course, I'm not expecting to be able to please all the people all the time, but what I do hope to do, and you know, the future will prove me right or wrong on this, what I do hope to do is please as many folk who are, if you like, using that well-trodden word, stakeholders, as is possible, as much of the time as I can do that. And therefore, I'm giving myself a whole year to confer with pretty much everyone involved, and people who've gone here before, the rewilding community in Scotland, of course the local community at all levels, and then come up with a master plan. So I'm determined not to do anything dumb early. I think this project has the chance, if I get it right, of being a really inspirational thing. And if it can limit its mistakes to small ones, it has a good chance of doing that.
The failed model, I mean, is that a fair perspective on the culture, I suppose, of the Highlands in many ways?
Well, look, it's a personal opinion and it's based on the motivation of my life, which is to try and do something about climate change. And I think the traditional model makes the climate problem worse. You know, if you're burning peat bogs in order to create a ground for shooting grouse and that sort of thing, And so that's the root of my critique. Of course, I recognize that lots of people would have a different view. But my argument is, and I hope that the future will bear me out with this project, actually there'll be more jobs in the outdoors for Highlanders. There'll be better jobs, and we will build biodiversity in doing this in the Highlands, which itself will be important for knock-on jobs, if you like, in the tourism industry. Because let's face it, a lot of these Highland upland areas where the sheep are roaming and, you know, the rich English come up to shoot red deer, there's not much biodiversity. The biodiversity has gone down, and that's not a good thing on our planet.
And there'll be a lot of gamekeepers probably listening to this thinking, but there are lots of jobs, there's lots of money in the local shops and the local hotels come from that model.
We'll beat them at that game. Just watch, wait and see. There'll be more money coming in if we go this green new model route.
You have the money from elsewhere to kind of invest in the Highlands, invest here. Some would say, you know, they're not in the same position to do what you're doing. How would you respond to that?
Well, you know, I have borrowed the money to do this. I have crowdfunded the money to buy the estate and to run it for a few years. So I'm under pressure to run it as a successful business, whatever I might want to do for the environment, because I have to service the debt and repay the debt. I'm a big believer in crowdfunding, and I think there's a future for that. And I guess, I mean, I have to find out. I'm at the bottom of learning curves. I'm kind of surprised that there haven't been more community crowdfunding exercises to, you know, buy more land and use it in community-centric ways.
Jeremy Leggett at Ben Lloyd Estate on Loch Ness, talking to Fiona Clark there. If you've got any thoughts on that, you can give us a call on 08085 92 95 00, or you can text us on 80295, or email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Some interesting stuff in that, Ewan.
Yeah, whether you agree with Jeremy or not, he certainly raises debate, and we'd certainly, as you say, welcome people's thoughts on it, because it's a different model, and as Jeremy was saying, it's a new experiment, and he'll be judged if he was right or he's wrong, but it's certainly something worth having a good look at, and we really would welcome folks' thoughts on it, because it's a radical departure from traditional estates at the moment.
No, absolutely. Anyway, Nan Shepherd's book, The Living Mountain, has been described as one of the finest pieces of nature writing ever written, and certainly I would, you know, endorse that view. I think it's just a superb piece of writing. It's written in the 1940s and incredibly sat in a drawer for, must have been about 30 years. It's effectively a love letter to the Cairngorms, featuring detailed descriptions of this rather beautiful environment.
Yeah, Jerry Sturgeon is a singer and a songwriter and an ecologist, and she's just released a new album inspired by that work, which is also called The Living Mountain.
Helen Needham and I spoke with Jenny recently, and she shared some of the field recordings she used within the album. And first up is a bird you'll recognise from the plateau, the ptarmigan.
Jenny, you're an ecologist as well as a musician, and I'm wondering how important the types of field recording that you're sharing with us today are to the musical work, how it informs the musical approach.
It definitely does. I think the first kind of project I did that started using field recordings was a commission for the National Trust for Scotland. I went out to St Kilda to celebrate. It was 30 years since they'd been given World Heritage Site status, and they wanted something to mark that, so they asked me to write some music, and I was lucky enough to get out there, and it was very clear that that was such an important part of that place. And I think in order to kind of transport listeners to that place, it was important to have those field recordings of the St Kilda Wren and of the wild, crazy weather in the record. And so I've sort of started doing that ever since then, really. It's just another element, I think, which kind of can draw in listeners and to me anyway, helps place that music in the landscape. And so including things like the Ptarmigan call and various different calls in the Living Mountain record just felt like the natural and right thing to do. And it also is one of those things that I use when I'm writing or composing a piece, is I'll have these sounds around me, listening to them through headphones or however, and that helps inform the sound of the piece as well, as much as just the writing that I've done or anything. It's the sounds that I hear that transport me to that place.
The call of the crested tit, very sharp, very precise.
And such incredible little birds. One of my favourite places in the Cairngorms National Park is Abernethy Forest, and I love getting to watch the crested tits, and they're just gorgeous little things, and the way that they use their crests for signalling and just hearing them is a beautiful thing. So of course they needed to be involved in the record as well.
Another sound which is very evocative, particularly in autumn in the mountains of Scotland, is the stags roaring as the rut takes place. It can be quite unsettling, actually, if you're not used to it. It's got an almost primeval quality to it. You've got that sound, but you've taken it a step further here with a bit of artistic license and made it sound even weirder.
Well, I think for this track, the birds, animals and insects wanted it to feel a little bit, almost a bit hazy, like on one of those days when you're up in the mountains and you think that you're hearing something, but you can't tell where it's coming from. And particularly, I think that sound of the roaring deer is one of those sounds. You know, it echoes through the valleys and is a really striking sound. So, yeah, we used a bit of poetic license and manipulated some of these calls. So it's a recording by a guy called Magnus Robb, who is a fantastic field recording person, and yeah, he supplied the samples of these different species.
So you've got Magnus Robb's recordings of red deer there, and then we moved into the sound of snipe, but I mean it's a slightly different take on snipe drumming there.
I think this is one of my favourite sounds, along with the curlew, the snipe drumming, and they create this incredible sound through the vibration of their feathers. I think it's used, I might be wrong, I'm sure some listeners will tell me if I'm wrong, but when the birds are displaying, they create this sound, and there's something just weird and magical about it.
I hardly like to interrupt that, I must confess. The sound of snipe drumming, which features in Jenny Sturgeon's new album, The Living Mountain. Visit her website, Jenny Sturgeon Music, that's all one word, jennysturgeonmusic.com, for more details. And we have to extend huge congratulations to her, because Jenny this week won the Best Acoustic Act at the Scottish Alternative Music Awards. Very talented lady, Ewan.
I'm just loving those sounds as well, and there's something about the sounds of nature that blend so beautifully if you've got the skill with music. And, Dan Shepherd's stuff is fantastic. But that sound of the snipe, I still maintain, if you hear that in the darkness and the winter, it's a scary old sound.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's a sound I more associate with summer evenings. I suppose the first time I actually heard it was down just at the foot of the campsies, and I'm talking 40 years ago, something like that, and I can almost smell warm grass, just hearing the sound. Anyway,
they do it when they're breeding. It's the main time that they do that display, but they also do it off and on during the winter, certainly the males will.
Yeah. You can hear more from Jenny in the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available now from BBC Sounds, or indeed any other podcast platform you may choose to use. Coming up on this programme, if you'd like to experience living in a bothy, you might be in with a shout, and I'll be looking at creatures that give off a glow.
Yeah, and we're still knee-deep in the mystery bird. I thought it was going to be really hard. Derek in fourth and Duncan in there disagree. They've got it correct. And Duncan, this is an interesting one. Duncan says, I was watching three sand martins at Nairn Harbour yesterday, low over the beach. Should they not be heading south? That's Duncan McCann from Nairn. It's a good question. If anybody's got any ideas, and get in touch. Anyway, here's this week mystery bird. Have a wee blast of this. So if you've got any idea that what that might be, and let's face it, loads of you do, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, the text number 80295, and you call Sam as well. He's busy this morning, 08085 92 95 00. I don't know, it's worthwhile giving any clues if everybody's getting it right.
Go on, sneak in a wee one. Go on, go for it.
Well, they're visitors.
Well, that's a clue.
Winter
sorts,
visitors.
I suppose. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's a start.
It's a start. Have a think about it. A recent survey carried out by the Scottish Outdoor Access Network has shown that while the number of folk using green spaces has gone through the roof during the pandemic, some rather alarming cuts have been made to access jobs. People on the ground like access officers and countryside rangers. Joining us now to tell us more is David Henderson Howitt, convener of the National Access Forum. Good morning, David.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Tell us a bit more about these survey findings. What do they show?
Well, I suppose, as a lot of people know, the access legislation was introduced about 15 years ago. And I think quite a lot of people would say that bringing in the right of responsible access is one of the best things that the Scottish Parliament has done. But since then, the number of access officers and countryside rangers on the ground has more or less halved. And this is really due to local authorities having to cut corners because they just haven't been allocating the money for access officers and countryside rangers. And as you say, there was a lot more use of the outdoors for people during the pandemic. But that really brought some of the tensions to light. And for example, on the National Access Forum, we heard about problems where there were people finding signs telling them to turn back when they're quietly walking along tracks they had every right to use on the one hand. But on the other hand, it was farmers as well who were finding that they had no one to turn to when they found themselves overwhelmed with visitors. They would hope to go to the access officer and get a bit of help and support. And the access officers themselves were being overwhelmed. And what that meant, of course, was there was no one to nip problems in the bud, because where things are working well, what access officers and countryside rangers do a fantastic job of knowing the ground, knowing the people, being able to get out there and, as I say, just nip problems in the bud, as well as doing their positive work of promoting paths, networks, running the local access forums and so forth.
So presumably at this time, is what we're going through, they play an even more important role in the countryside and our relationship with it.
Well, exactly. They're extremely important, and I think they're finding themselves under a lot of pressure. And it's obviously difficult for local authorities who have hard choices to make in terms of budgets. But actually, the amount of money needed for the access officers, there's a tiny proportion of overall local authority budgets is probably about 0.1%. So it's quite an easy target to make a small cut. But on the other hand, it does have it's a short-term cut, but it brings these long-term ramifications. And it does, if you like, it's the oil in which it oils the wheels of the access legislation, and that's what is causing difficulties at the moment.
David, if there's people listening to this who are either working for, you know, local or regional authorities or possibly even charities, you know, and that they are also facing very, very difficult times, make the case. Why is it important to actually keep these people in post, to have them on site?
Well, I think we start from the point of view why it's important to have access to Scotland's outdoors. And I think the answer to that is it brings huge benefits. It brings huge benefits in terms of health and well-being for the people who go out and enjoy the access. It also brings benefits for the tourism economy, for other recreation aspects of the economy. So it brings economic benefits and social benefits. But for this to work, you just need people who are available to deal with the inevitable tensions that arise. Most people want to come out and enjoy themselves. The vast majority of farmers and landowners are very welcoming to people coming on and making use of these rights of responsible access. But inevitably, problems arise. And often these are problems. In many ways, it's a question of communication. You know, always you're going to have more people coming out who aren't perhaps used to going out to the outdoors. And it's just a question of getting messages across to people about what responsible behaviour is. Simple things, closing gates or whatever it may be, or leaving gates open if they're already open. And these are the sort of messages that need to be got out, and it's the job of the access officers. It's envisaged very much in the legislation was introduced 15 years ago, so it would be the job of these access officers and countryside rangers of doing the job of communicating the messages of responsible access and dealing with the inevitable problems that arise on the ground. I mean, whether it's to do with sort of parking or whatever it might be, they can get out there or block gates and they can help deal with it.
David, you said, you know, it was one of the greatest things the Scottish Parliament has done so far, that, you know, the right of responsible access. If it was created by the government, should it not be a government-funded post, you know, a national ranger service incorporating access officers rather than expecting local authorities to fund it?
Well, what I actually did, I think the idea was that it would, because often the problems are local problems, they're best addressed at the local level. So in fact, it's quite complicated how local authority finance works, but the Scottish Government does actually allocate £8 million a year for local authorities to do this job. So they've given local authorities the job, but they've also allocated this £8 million a year. But that goes into the great pot of money that local authorities get. And then the principle of local delegation to local authorities can then decide how to spend that money. And I think the worry is that probably out of that £8 million they're being allocated by the Scottish Government, they're maybe only spending about half of it on access, and the other half of it goes onto other things. So I think that's where the difficulty arises.
I must confess, how confident are you that in the current economic climate, that what you hope will happen?
Well, I think we've just got to keep the pressure on. As you said earlier, I'm convened in the National Access Forum. We've written to Scottish ministers about this. The very fact you've got me on the programme this morning is hopefully another way of just getting the message across that whether we're talking about the beneficiaries, the people who go out into Scotland's outdoors, or whether we're talking about the farmers and landowners, everyone benefits from having good quality access officer services. And there are some local authority areas and national parks as well where it's working well. I've come across people who are, you know, doing an absolutely first-class job. It's just small teams they have, but with their small teams of a handful of people, they're doing just what's needed in terms of building good relationships with the farmers.
Sometimes it doesn't take much to actually make a big difference. And David, thank you very much for taking the time to join us this morning.
Good, thank you very much indeed.
David Henderson Howitt there, who's the convener of the National Access Forum. Any thoughts on that? You can text us on 80295 or call us on 08 085 92 95 00. Coming up, we'll be taking a return visit to what's known as the Secret Howff, and a walk on the Duns Castle Nature Reserve, and our ever-popular mystery bird. He has a slightly different sound from the one we played earlier. Now, I know you have some correct answers. I, however, have some wrong ones, which I'm going to do first.
Hurrah.
Hurrah. Barry Sutherland, our South Yorkshire ornithological correspondent, continues his losing streak when he says, dare I say what I think it is? Oh, dear, Barry, dare, go on. He says, I'll say it's a thrush, a missel thrush, to break it down. Close, Barry, but no coconut. Johnny McLeod from Kennaway says, morning, guys, from a blustery Elian Fife, waiting for the sunrise. Oh, there's no suggestion there at all what kind of bird it is. Gary in Pennycook says, good morning, mystery bird is a pied wagtail. No, but I see where you're coming from. And Ian in Gart Karen says, I'm on my way to work, but looking forward to listening Sunday morning after dog walks over a real coffee. Could this week's bird be the happy screaming jay? It could be, but it's not. And it says, thanks very much to the whole team. And that's Ian in Gart Karen.
Yeah, folk that did get it correct, Alison Beattie in Edinburgh, Mary McIntyre in St Andrews, Pamela in Edinburgh, Lorna McGregor in Aberfeldy, Doug in Olness, and Willie in Brechin. So it's not as hard as I thought it was going to be, but if you do know what that is, give Sam a ring. He's on 08 085 92 95 00, and tell us what you're doing this weekend if the sun eventually gets up.
It's only a matter of time. We just need to wait. We just need to be patient. We're going to be talking about... Sorry?
Patience, strong point.
Yeah, well, it's not entirely your strong point, that's true. We're going to be talking about Bothies shortly and the project that might let you spend time in some of them. But first, talk of Bothies led us to remember a trip I made a few years ago with BBC Scotland poet in residence at the time, Rachel McCrum. One of Rachel's interests was Bothies, so we decided to take her to a very special one, the secret house at Venevoord in the eastern Cairngorms. Now, the house was built back in the 1950s by a group of young men from Aberdeen who wanted a shelter to enjoy the hills at the weekend. So here's Rachel and myself nearing the secret house. The day is so short at the moment that the sun seems to hurtle round. I mean, it's only an hour or so since the sun was shining straight up the glen, and now it's shining back on the hills that we came from. And look, see the mountain here?
Yeah.
See the black ear tips just against the snowbank?
I do.
We caught the hare first, white with those black-tipped ears flinching above us. The cold enough to taste, the silence enough to hear, the light pale enough to feel. My lacking eyes thinking the land grand, but empty until the grouse flew out ahead of us. And the pose of stags and picking hinds on the ridge above let us know we were observed. Anyway, we turned at the right rowan tree, paused to query a path I didn't know, but felt somewhere that this was the end of the road. The track ahead snowed up past Burns to Benevard. One way, further, deeper, colder in. The other, back to the car park. Past the stillness of that hare, we saw two backpacks flip fast over the hill's lip.
I'm just laughing because we've come up to the point where we know the secret Bothy is. And just as we came round the corner, these other two hikers appeared out of the heather, and I bet you that's where they're heading to. Guaranteed. Right, come on.
Not so secret.
Well... it's not unknown. This is the great thing about it. It's not unknown, but I mean, there's a real sort of, you know, bond of trust. Folk don't blab about it.
I like that.
Spotted it.
That's gorgeous.
Isn't it fantastic?
Oh, look at that.
Isn't that just brilliant?
What a precious thing. Let's go have some coffee.
Oh, yeah. It's unbelievably well blended into the hillside, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I could stay here for a while, I think. Oh, what a gorgeous thing to do, though. What a generous thing to do, to construct something like this, I think.
We panted our own way up, saw those cunning stones grey-stacked, and I thought it was only polite to knock the half-height door before we entered.
How are you doing, lads?
We thought Ashie's name would be enough, but they were wary until we earned our seats on those boards with our own stories. Nonsense, really. A tale spun here, a family yarn unravelled there, just chat, a tumble of words to clear minds.
What do you think of the inside of it?
I think it's very cosy. I love that the stone is so visible, but it's actually, it's hard to tell the bits that are the natural rock and also the bits that have been constructed. And there's bits of graffiti and people have carved in their names into the rock and into the wood. And it's very, you know, it's solid. It feels solid. You feel protected, but not cramped, I think, as well.
It's quite tent-like in construction. It is low to the ground. I mean, you know, only the penitent man may enter. You kind of come in crawling because there's no way you can do it even at a stoop, you know, coming in through that door. And then it gets slightly higher. It's the fact they've sawn the legs off the chairs too, you know, so it can, you can sit with comfort.
Everything,
you know,
to scale, yeah.
They told us they'd come from Ayrshire. How? When? We'd never seen them ahead of us this whole time. The steelworks had closed, and rather than sitting on our backsides getting depressed, they were bagging them in rows. 206 at the last take, although finding it harder to get out now the winter was in. But they chuckled, our wives like us out of the house at any rate.
I'd love to see it in the evening, actually, by candlelight. Maybe not tonight, but...
no, possibly not, you know, and with some friends in here and a bit of a dram going. And in the corrugated iron roof, they put in one sheet of that clear plastic, you can see it, and it was raining earlier, and I love that sound. And it reminds me of lots of childhood holidays and caravans and tents and things like that.
Yeah. I think it's a beautiful thing. I think the fact that it's been so well constructed and maintained.
Inspiration.
I like it. I'm thinking about a few things.
And then I thought I heard one say, "It's the stories that open us." And when he said stories, I heard, "It's the feet carrying us through open air that free us. It's the knowledge of our land that binds us. It's that which costs us nothing that heals us." So we sat with our pieces on sawn-down chairs tight against the wind, hail graining off the one clear plastic corrugated sheet, some act of generosity from those that build these things. They sat silent, ghosting faint smiles as we spoke, a little self-consciously for the tape. Outside and after, they got the march on us, headed off back down the glen. Our eyes dropped to catch a red flower rare amongst the heather, the shiny droppings, the pale and clutching lichen. When we looked up again, we couldn't see them, not for money, nor for love.
Radio Scotland poet in residence Rachel McCrum, and the secret house at Benavour. I had forgotten what a lovely voice she has. I was just sitting here really enjoying listening to her.
Yeah, I know, it must have been great sitting by the fire having a dram and that incredible building, because, well, you told the story, and obviously not a lot longer story. They kind of smuggled the corrugated iron up the hill.
Yeah. Well, better still, they took it out of Aberdeen on the bus.
and then
marched it miles up the track. But it was about the time, I think it was about the time of the Royal Coronation that they were doing it, and they fell foul of, I think it was Royal Coronation Ale, and fell asleep in front of the big house and woke up in the morning thinking, you know, because they didn't want to be spotted, you know, and to sort of scamper up the track. There was a lovely moment there just as the music finished, you know, and I wish I could have indicated to Ron, our audio engineer, to bring my microphone up as well, because the music was playing and there were heringulls crying above me. You know, obviously just congregating, etc., and it mixed together beautifully. Continuing the bothy theme, albeit possibly slightly more salubrious bothies than the secret house, Bothy Project is a network of small-scale, off-grid art residency spaces across Scotland. To tell us more about them and some exciting opportunities coming up is Bothic Project Coordinator Leslie Young. Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well, thank you.
I'm delighted to hear it. Listen, give us a bit of a background to the Bothic Project. What is it? How's it going to work?
Well, Bothic Project is a small arts charity, and we were established in 2011 by an artist. And it was with the ambition of providing residencies for artists in the Scottish landscape and allowing them time to work in the landscape. In the sense of kind of, you know, the history of Bothies being places where labour or kind of work kind of took place. But in our instance, it's for artists. So for writers, visual artists, poets, playwrights, designers. So since 2011, 300 artists, more than 300 artists have connected with the Scottish landscape.
You say Bothies, I mean, describe some of the buildings, because the one Mark was talking about is lovely, but some of them are really quite striking.
Yes, our Bothies have been built. The first one was built at Inshriach outside Aviemore in 2012. It was built, so they're very small buildings, 30 square meters. So very small and compact, and there's everything is kind of inside them that you might need to kind of, you know, stay warm and be cosy and work kind of basically with a desk. But they're warm and dry. They've got wood-burning stoves. We've got solar power kind of going to them. So there's a sense that they're off-grid, but they're powered and using the kind of the resources of kind of the landscape to you know, make them nice places to be.
But you've just announced something a wee bit different. Tell us about that.
Yes, because obviously kind of with the kind of the sort of impact of the kind of pandemic, normally the kind of the artists that would go to the Bothies to work, they might be coming from other parts of Scotland or kind of the rest of the UK or indeed kind of from other places around the world. But obviously, you know, that's not been possible kind of in this year. So we've constructed we've extended the kind of the relationships that we have with the communities that our Bothies kind of sit in, and with this project, the neighbourhood residencies, we're kind of inviting people from all walks of life to spend time at the Bothies. So you don't need to be an artist or a creative person in the sort of you don't need to call yourself an artist to go. So we've sort of decided that in this instance, it just means that the people will have to travel only very short distances to go and spend time there.
When you talk about very short distances, how short a distance? And once they actually get there, if you get one of these Bothy residencies, what do you have to do in return? What's the payoff?
Well, the time at the Bothy, they'll range from sort of 4 days to sort of 7 days, and you can stay in the Bothies kind of overnight, the time that you're at the Bothy is basically kind of yours to do with what you will. So whether that's kind of sort of to be productive in some way or to use it as a kind of restorative kind of period, we'd ask you to keep an audio diary. The crucial thing is that the Bothy project runs, one is on the Isle of Egg, one is in just outside Aviemore, and then we're working with the Ascent Foundation in Ascent, just outside Loch Inver. So the ambition is that the residents will be on residency at the same time. So we want them to have conversations between each other. So it's really a key ambition of the what we want is to kind of generate kind of conversation and discussion between the three communities.
Do they get paid for this?
They do. There is a fee for their time and for their engagement with the conversations. Because we're gonna produce podcasts kind of after the residencies take place, which will be sort of shared publicly. So yes, there is a small fee.
I find that absolutely extraordinary. Not only do you stay in a Bothy, you get paid to stay in a Bothy, yeah, and recuperate and produce something or whatever. And the audio diaries. How are you going to be showcasing those at the end of the day? Is there an attempt to turn this into something?
Yes, these will be kind of, they'll be the sort of diaries that we hope people will keep kind of on the time that they're kind of on residency. And then we'll aim to have sort of three-way conversations kind of between the kind of residents. And then we also have the kind of the great opportunity to invite people who've already been to the Bothies, so whether that's artists or designers or writers, we can get them to kind of join the kind of conversation, to kind of produce kind of interesting podcasts. So whatever way the conversation and the discussion goes between the residents, we feel like we've got kind of other people that we can kind of connect with and kind of add to the conversation to expand the kind of the interest of the topic of whatever the residents are kind of keen to talk about.
I think it's an absolutely lovely idea. Leslie, thank you very much for joining us this morning. If you live near any of those three Bothies, Inchreich, Egg and Assent, and that has piqued your interest, and I'm fairly certain it will have done, there's a link to the Bothy Project website from ours. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Now, sounds great. It'd be quite good to feature some of those audio diaries on Out of Doors as
well. That's a very good idea, actually. That hadn't crossed my mind. That's a very good idea. You know, because, I mean, certainly I know the Bothy at Inchreich that she's talking about. I don't know the one in Egg or Assent. But, you know, I mean, let's when you're talking about if you live close, presumably if you live on Egg.
Yeah, it's all close.
Yeah, exactly. Our deciduous trees are a bit of a sorry sight at the moment, but some still have a few bright berries bravely hanging on. Not many, has to be said. Actually, on that subject, on bright berries hanging on, we've got some more wrong answers about the mystery bird. Helen in Cumbernauld says, guys, going to stop with a bird. My cat and dog are going mental looking for it. Sorry about that, Helen. Keith said, is it a house martin? He's trucking the post up and off a windy M74, he says. Pat and Paisley says, is the mystery bird a brambling? Lovely wee thing. Saw one of those in the West Highland Way. It's not, unfortunately, Pat. Moratui, Brotty Ferry says, is a red wing? Think I'll be making Christmas cake this weekend since we can't travel more than 5 miles. You know, I was going to make a Christmas cake and then realised we still had half of the Christmas cake from last year. James of Stonehaven says, is it a red wing? Again, very, very close guesses, but really just not quite there. Going back to the red berries on the trees and everything else, our resident expert in folklore, Mr. Ewan McElraith, spinster of this parish, has been unearthing some tales about one such tree.
The spirit shivered as an icy blast of the raw north wind blew the last leaf from the tree. Only a handful of bright red berries remained as a reminder of warmer days, days when the forest was full of life and light. Now the long, cold nights of winter stretched out before her. A winter which would see her do battle with the forces of evil who roamed freely in the quietness of wintertide. For this was when the folk she protected were vulnerable. A gap in the window, a door left open, an unlit fire, easy access for evil intent on doing harm. Every season of cold, Mi'alma roamed the forest, eyes ever watching upward for the Sluagh, a malevolent flock of spirits that haunted the Hebrides. They fly through the night sky, snatching mortals, then taking them into the earth or dropping them from great heights till their death. The Beovin Slith appears as a beautiful young woman wearing a long green dress. Look closely, though, and you'll see she has cloven hoofs instead of feet. She is no normal woman. She is the vampire of the Highlands. Or worst of all, the Nakilevi in Orkney. Part horse, part devilish man. No skin, black blood coursing through its yellow veins, pale sinews and powerful muscles. The breath wilting crops and infecting livestock, causing devastation and famine. As these beasts of the darkness emerge from the scuttling clouds which blocked the moon, Mi'alma streaked from the forest below and struck the creatures with a branch of the rowan tree, which sent them spiralling to earth to a certain end. But they were many, and she, the essence of the rowan, was only one. Each winter she battled, but she could never win. She needed the help of these very folk she was trying to protect. And that's exactly what happened. No tree, no plant, no charm has ever been used as much in the battle against the forces of darkness as the rowan tree. But why? Well, the physical characteristics of the tree may have contributed to its protective reputation. Each berry, if you cut through, has a tiny five-pointed star or pentagram opposite the stalk. And the pentagram, of course, is an ancient protective symbol. Early Christians seeing it as representing the five wounds of Christ. Others, like the followers of Wiccan, see it as a symbol of faith. People also believed the colour red was the best protection against magic. So the rowan's vibrant display of berries in autumn may have further contributed to its protective abilities. The tree also appears in Norse mythology. The gods made man first from an ash tree, but the first woman was made from rowan. And the tree has a further link with Thor. The god needed to cross a fast-flowing river. Climbing out on the opposite side proved more difficult than he'd expected. A rowan tree bent down from the bank to lend a branch, and Thor hauled himself free. And to this day, the rowan is known in some parts as the Wayfarer tree, the tree used to guide lost travellers. In the National Museum of Edinburgh, there are examples of the small crosses made from rowan twigs and red thread that folk kept in their pockets when travelling or sewn into their clothing for protection. Now, here's a top tip. If you find a person dancing in a fairy ring, obviously they can't escape, but you can reach a rowan branch in for them. They grab the branch and you pull them free. In Ireland, berries could cure the wounded, and having a rowan branch in the bed in Scotland was a guarantee against possession by spirits, or possibly unwanted attentions during the night. Of course, we make wine and spirit from the berries, and the incredible rowan jelly to accompany the festive bird. Even the building of houses involved rowan, because, as Mialma was only too aware, evil is always looking for an easy way in. Plant a tree by the front door, a practice still carried out in New Zealand, a custom taken by Scottish immigrants. In North Yorkshire, builders used the wood for the side supports for a farmhouse fireplace. They're known as witches' post, and carvings and crosses make them doubly effective. Here, builders used the wood for the chimney crossbeams or lintels. Farmers hung rowan sprigs in the rafters of cowsheds. In some places, they wrapped plaited sprigs around the horns of the cows. Rowan garlands were thrown around the necks of pigs to ward off evil magic, and the cows were fed rowan berries to help with a safe and an easy birth, and the milk from those cattle was prized by new mothers. The list goes on. Rowan trees dominated the lives of our ancestors. People planted rowan trees in churchyards to deter evil spirits, and pallbearers would rest coffins under rowan trees on the way to the graveyard. Even boats carried the wood on board, because sailors believed a vessel with rowan wood on board couldn't capsize, and no man could drown. The rowan. What a tree. Grab a berry and plant one today, because you never know when you'll need protection from the darkness.
The rowan or wayfaring tree, courtesy of Mr. McElroy. That business about putting a sprig in your bed and it keeping you from unwanted attention. Define unwanted attention.
Well, it depends how big a branch you put in.
I would have thought holly would have been a better idea, some nettles or something.
That keeps away the forces of evil.
I remember somebody asking...
Hey, buddy, go on.
You remember we used to do Beechcroft potting shed from here in Aberdeen, in the gardening phone-in programme, and somebody said, oh, can I plant some rowan berries and what have you? I don't remember it being that straightforward. I thought you had to keep them in the fridge for a period of time. I can't remember how long it was. It was like a couple of weeks or something like that. And then because the birds, the seeds normally pass through birds and things like that, you have to kind of mush up and take the seeds out of the berry, and that can be planted. But I could be wrong in that.
Top tips here on Out of Doors. Barry Sutherland's been in touch.
Again.
And he's talking about the sand martins that were spotted by Duncan in the Moray Firth. He's suggesting there might have been late fledglings that were just too daft or unprepared to go south and were left behind the parents. But because there's enough food around, they've managed to get their strength up, and they might be heading south soon. So that's the best bet so far.
Yeah. Wonder if they'll actually make it in this kind of cold. I don't know. You were talking first thing in the programme about, you know, you could see all the stars and everything. I looked up at the time and I thought, I can't see anything. You know, it was cloudy here. But there's obviously just a wall of cloud, because it's now to the south of me. I can see the edge, you know, of that particular weather front. And it's clear, clear skies here. Not a breath of wind either. It's lovely.
Well, we've got loads of wind, and the good news today at 7:30 as the sun's making its appearance. It's going to be all right.
We knew it would come. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, well, frankly, there's no excuse, and we will send Matron round later. But there are a few ways of listening again.
You can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, available from BBC Sounds. We often ask people where they listen to the podcast. If you'd like to let us know, you can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Ariadne Ulner in Germany did. Says, dear Mark and Ewing, thank you for your Scotland Outdoors podcast. On my way to work, I travel between Bonn and Koblenz and enjoy listening to the podcast, which provide me with a virtual holiday experience. Well, I'm glad to hear it. Best regards, Ariadne Ulner.
And we also received an email from Priya Yelka in Glasgow. She says, I listen to your fantastic programme every Saturday morning. I was so happy to hear your lovely Diwali wishes last Saturday. Although celebrations here are very different this year, your programme was a lovely start to the day, apart from you getting firecrackers thrown at you.
Well, I know, well, that was it. Yeah, well, that's always fun. Your show is so inspiring, she went on. Every Saturday during these difficult times, I've listened to the various places that you and your listeners have visited in Scotland. When the rules allowed, and it was safe to do so, I was able to visit the Myatt Hill, Connick Hill and Mugdock Country Park. I loved it. Shaking my head at myself as I've not been to these places before. Although I only attempted 4 miles of the West Highland Way, I look forward to exploring more next year when safe and allowed to do so. Keep up the great work, and I'm sending you a big virtual hug. Well, thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you.
Oh, that's quite nice, wasn't it? Wish you, your listeners and families a very happy Diwali, and best wishes for the new year. Wishing you good health, happiness and peace. And that's best wishes from Priya in Glasgow. Coming up, we take you on a walk to the intriguingly named Hen Poo. Had me back. Glow-in-the-dark beasties. And, of course, we reveal the identity of this week's mystery bird. Here it is again.
So, if you think you know what that is, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text number is 80295. Sam's also ready to take your calls. He's on 08 085 92 95 00, and I've seen them absolutely feasting on apples, big flocks of them, when they arrive for the winter.
Yeah, I have a very clear mental image of one, and it was in, in Kelly Castle down in Fife, and it was a frosty morning, and the apples had fallen off the trees, and this one example of this bird had been working away at this apple, and there was just the thinnest disc at the top and the thinnest disc at the bottom, and just more or less a thread connecting the two, and somehow it balanced, but it just pecked away all the flesh of the apple. Anyway, our occasional series of lockdown walks takes us to the borders, to the Duns Castle Nature Reserve this week. Radio Scotland's rugby commentator Stuart McFarlane actually lives in the area, and this is one of his favourite walks.
I'm making my way down towards an entrance into Duns Castle, and just in front of me is the Gothic Double Tower Pavilion Lodge, and through the archway the road continues down towards the castle. It's about 200 yards to the front of the castle. That road is private, so I'm going to head towards the right hand side. Looking down through that archway the road splits a beautiful lime avenue, trees that were planted around 1800, and many of them were professionally corrected in 1881 after a really violent storm caused a lot of damage to the woodland in the surrounding areas. It's an absolutely gorgeous entrance into the castle. I really consider to be the centre point of this section of parkland. It's a lake which is a mile long, and today there's two swans on the water, very serene. I've just passed about 25 mallards who are very playful and active, looking for some food. A cormorant just a few moments ago just flew past in the direction of the Mill Dam, which is a little bit further down from where I am just now. But this body of water around these parts is very affectionately referred to as the hen poo. Now, calling anything the hen poo is unusual, particularly calling a body of water that. But I suppose it was the heron pond at one time, and its name has changed over time. Now, I can tell you that the hen poo, for some time, was a favourite curling spot for local curlers and visiting curlers to the town when it was an open-air and more rustic sport than it is today. And just past the very first cattle grid, there's a stone to mark the 200th anniversary of Dunn's Curling Club. But there's also another very interesting story, an untold story about the hen poo. Because just after the end of the Second World War, there was a weapons amnesty. And the old Berwickshire Police Constabulary, as it was then, had requested that all weapons from the local area, from returning soldiers, were then brought to the police station in Dunn's. Well, they were overwhelmed by the number of weapons that arrived. So much so that they took somewhat drastic measures. At night, they came out in a boat, perhaps made several journeys, onto the water, taking the boat to the deepest part of the hen poo, and yes, they dumped the weapons into the murky depths of the water. So the hen poo is a famous sporting venue around Dunn's as an old ice rink and curling rink, but it's also the home of many World War II weapons. The ground is now very clutchy. Just passing the second cattle grid, the surface does change somewhat. So this is where you really need a good pair of walking boots on rather than just trainers if you want to tackle the second portion of the looped pathway around the hen poo. But the hen poo isn't the only body of water up here, because I'm now at not a crossroads, but I've got a choice if I want to make my way left round towards the Hyde. Or if I head right, I would head down towards the Mill Dam or the Perch Pond. And in a sense, the Mill Dam was essentially created as a source of water for a working sawmill. The sawmill is no more. And at one time, the sawmill was also a neighbour of the old Cumbledge Mill, a very well-known blanket-making factory, which closed its doors for the final time back in 1972. And Cumbledge Burn runs very close to where I am just now. But today I'm going to head left, and I'm going to head up towards the Hyde. I'm just keeping an eye on my watch, because I've actually got quite a bit of walking to do if I want to get up to another vantage point just on the outskirts of the town. There's certainly been a fair amount of rain here recently. I've just made my way down to the bird-watching Hyde, and it says, Hyde closed, wren nesting inside, wildlife camera recording in progress. So a visit to the Hyde is for another day. Onwards to Harden's Hill. I'm just coming out onto the Snuffy Hole car park, which is at the top of Harden's Hill. And you can just about see views down towards Dunn's and off the Merse. There's a sort of thicker, higher plantation now than there used to be. But you can make out the town nonetheless. But the view that I've come up here to enjoy is just round the corner. So I'm now going to head down towards Longformacus Road, walk about 100 yards or so to enjoy a very different view, but a very, very nice panoramic view of the Borders. I'm just about 100 or so yards away from the car park now, but from here you get a stunning view off the central Borders, and you can pinpoint and pick out so many different landmarks. For instance, the Eildon Hills are not in their Scots View formation, but you can identify them nonetheless. And at the moment, there's a layer of cloud just over the top of Big Cheviot and some mist hugging the very top of Hume Castle, and it makes it look very atmospheric. It really is a stunning panoramic view. But listen, don't take my word for it. Here's a verse or two from poet Jimmy McFarlane. Some praise the scenes of foreign lands and sing of warmer climes. Some say the Alps are simply grand and Italy's divine. Some praise the land of midnight sun, but wander where you will, there's none can match nor yet surpass the view of Harden's Hill. I couldn't put it better myself. Now, did I bring that flapjack with me?
Radio Scotland's rugby commentator Stuart McFarlane on the Dunn's Castle Nature Reserve. I haven't heard that word clatchy in years. You know, exactly.
I've never heard it at all.
Really? No.
You could probably do a whole programme on words like clatchy or cloggy or cleggy, on the miserableness of a Scottish winter.
You were talking about rowans earlier. Andy King says, "Good morning, lads. All the stock of berries wanted to share that yesterday a yellow-bellied rowan looked bedecked with odd-shaped fruit. Turned out to be 6 blackbirds, 3 robins and a solitary corby, all picking the berries off. Lasted all day." Alison Danex says, "There's a tree in Pitcapel Wood, which I measured with a ball of wool having a 10-metre circumference. It's a beech tree, making it... I'm not sure why this falls, making it 587 years old, born in 1433. Not its real name, but I call him Bacchus, god of wine, health and agriculture. Pitcapel overlooks much of the farming land near Inverurie." And Leslie in Edinburgh says, "With the exception of my first floor flat, I've planted a rowan in every garden I have owned. My current garden is 2, which are both seedlings from the last house. The trees seeded easily in air, but seem more reticent in Edinburgh. Love, Ewan's folklore." There you go.
Well, thank you very much. Another email flooded in from Dave, said, "Great show as always. I listen to Out of Doors every week from Milton Keynes in Buckinghamshire. Always the perfect way to start the weekend." Well, thank you very much, Dave.
Excellent, thank you. Now, on this week's edition of Landward on BBC Scotland, you went to find out about the evacuation of the Focus St Kilda, which is what, 1930?
Yeah, 29th of August 1930. They arrived at Loch Allen in Morven, and for many, it was the first time they would have been on the mainland. Now, Cameron Wilson's mother, May, was a young girl at the time and was there by the shore, along with many of the locals, to welcome the new arrivals.
Well, just there is the pier where the St Kildians disembarked from the HMS Harebell. My mother was just a young girl, and yes, she was here, as were most of the population who had come down to see them arriving. A good Highland welcome.
But there was a bit of a media scrum as well.
There was a media scrum, which did spoil things for the St Kildians. They weren't used to people sticking cameras in their faces, asking questions, and local people would be speaking to them, and they would come between them, and it really upset them.
So they must have been around when you were growing up.
Yes, they were. Mm-hmm. Lovely people. Friendly people, nice people, hospitable people. Yeah, they were all lovely folk.
But a huge shock, complete change in their life.
For most of them, yes, because they'd never been on the mainland before. They'd never left the island. And yes, it was a shock for the older people. The younger people took it in their stride. But but the older people, being more set in their ways, found it hard to adapt.
So why did they come here?
They came here because the government arranged with the Forestry Commission, who had just started, that there was work for them here and homes for them here. That's basically why they came here.
Must have been a real shock, though, working for a living.
Yes, it was a real shock.
Subsistence living.
Yeah, it was. They had to work here from 8 to 5 o'clock, and they were paid, I think, if I remember right, reading that they were paid 38 shillings per week. And they found it very hard to survive on 38 shillings because they had to buy coal, they had to heat their houses, obviously, they had the lighting and food to buy, whereas on St Kilda, most of that stuff was free. And everyone had a few sheep in St Kilda and their own cow. So it was a big, big change for them coming here.
So the people helped them through that?
Well, I think so, yeah. Yeah, they were made very welcome.
It's a real piece of history, though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, but look around you. You're surrounded by history here.
Cameron Wilson on the arrival of the folk from St Kilda to the mainland in 1930, and you can catch Landward on the BBC iPlayer. Interesting, he constantly referred to them as St Kildians. I would have said St Kildans.
Yeah, I did ask him. Well, I would have said St Kildans, but I asked him about St Kildians, and he said, well, that's what we called them, so who are we to disagree? But if you know better than that, 0808 592 9500, if you've got descendants of St Kilda in your family, are they St Kildans or St Kildians?
Let us know. 0808 592 9500, and give Sam a shout. Now, this time of year, I must confess, I have torches to hand all the time. I've got one sitting next to me at the moment, just in case the BBC switch the lights off, as they tend to do. A couple of weeks ago, we basically concentrated on the dark, because obviously we're coming into winter time and how we should embrace the dark. And it crossed my mind that there are quite a few creatures out there that can actually generate their own light. In 1954... Jim Lovell, a fighter pilot with the US Navy, was on a night flying exercise in the Pacific. He'd taken off from the USS Shangri-La a couple of hours previously and was on his way back to it when his jet suffered near complete electrical failure. He had no instruments, no radio, no means of communication. It was pitch black outside and pitch black in his cockpit. He'd no idea where he was, and even more worrying, absolutely no idea where the aircraft carrier was, and below him was the biggest body of water on the planet. Now, Lovell knew he was in trouble. The clock was ticking. Eventually, he'd run out of fuel and he'd be forced to eject into the sea. He was getting ready to do just that when he noticed something strange. Below him, in amongst all that darkness, he could see a faint glow, a sort of pale bluish streak. It took him a few minutes to work out that what he was looking at were living landing lights, bioluminescent marine organisms churned up in the wake of the very aircraft carrier he desperately needed to find. So with nothing to lose, Lovell followed the trail, found the carrier, landed successfully, and 16 years later became a household name around the world as the commander of Apollo 13. The sea was luminous in specks and in the wake of the vessel of a uniform, slightly milky colour. When the water was put into a bottle, it gave out sparks. That's the first entry in Charles Darwin's notebook, written while he was aboard the Beagle in 1832. What Darwin was seeing was exactly the same kind of bioluminescent beastie that had saved Jim Lovell's life. Lots of marine creatures are capable of producing light. There are about 1,500 species of fish that are known to luminesce, but some jellyfish can do it, worms, crustaceans, starfish, even certain types of sharks. Now, here on land, some mushrooms can produce their own light. It's called foxfire. You get bioluminescent algae. I think I saw some once in a cave on Skye. Bacteria, insects can all glow with a flow.
We've known about glow-in-the-dark critters for a long time. In 350 BC, Aristotle described bioluminescence as a cold light. Cold, he argued, in that it doesn't produce any heat. 400 years later, Pliny the Elder wrote that if you rub the slime of a certain jellyfish onto a walking stick, you could make it double up as a torch. Not as daft as it sounds, apparently, because it works. And in the last century, during the Second World War, the Japanese army dredged up huge numbers of ostracods, sea fireflies, dried them out and gave packets of their tiny desiccated bodies to the troops. Now, you could keep these things for years, but as soon as you mix them up with water in a small glass jar and give them a bit of a shake, the bodies of the sea fireflies would emit a pale blue light that was bright enough for soldiers to read maps by, but not so bright that the enemy could see you. For anything to glow, it needs to produce a substance called luciferin. Lucifer, you'll recall, means light-bringer. Combine luciferin with oxygen in the body, and you get a chemical reaction that produces light. Some species are so good at this that they can actually control how bright the light is and even change the colour of the light. But if you think about it, why do creatures light themselves up? Surely it's just attracting attention, telling predators where you are. Well, yes and no. Take sea sparkle, for example. Now, I've never been lucky enough to witness this personally, and I would love to swim in it one day, but it does happen around our coasts. It's caused by a plankton called Noctiluca scintillans. When waves break, or if you swim in it, or if you throw a stone into the water, Noctiluca responds to the disturbance by producing tiny flashes of blue light. When lots of them do it together, it can startle a predator, and even temporarily backlight that predator, potentially making it more visible to even bigger predators. I love the name for this phenomenon, by the way. Scientists have dubbed it the burglar alarm effect. Creatures bioluminesce for a variety of reasons. To attract mates, to feed, to protect themselves, even to communicate. There is an argument that bioluminescence is so widespread, it may be the most common form of communication on the planet. Now, for us, the ability to glow has always been seen as magical, otherworldly. Saints have halos that glow, angels glow, gods, fairies, djinns. But sadly, we don't. Or, until quite recently, we didn't think we did. According to Japanese researchers, we do emit light in the visible spectrum, but it's just too dim for our eyes to pick up. So, there we have it. All we have to do is to stop being dim and make more of an effort to shine. Sounds like every school report card I ever got.
Sad but true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was on Arend, a witch's sabbat, and one of the witches was describing the colours of the aurora around people. Yeah. And the producer who was with me was kind of bright green with red, and I was grey all over.
Puts your gas at a peep, doesn't it? Right, yeah. Moving on to the mystery part. Correct bird guesses came in from Susie Spott, Ross and Tainault, Ian Strathpeffer, Alec Anderson in Carbridge, Ram in Edinburgh, Vera in Angus, Margaret in Huntley, Ian Blackburn, Ranel near Biggar, and Katie in Perth. They all got it right. Good for them.
Yeah, so did Colin Abercrombie in Dunblane, Jackie Kerr in Corbridge, and Laura Sim in Lochwinnock. So, too easy yet again.
Well, I wouldn't say that necessarily. Oliver in Portobello got it wrong, however, says it's a mystery bird, a wren. His weekend's going to be revolving around his three-month spaniel puppy with a wild swim or two fitted in for the polar bear challenge this winter. You need help, Oliver. And Lynn D'Agostino in Fife says, is the sound of bird a brown thrasher? I don't even know what a brown thrasher is. I thought it was a shark. Maybe that's a thresher. I'm not sure. Anyway, the actual correct answer is a field fare, and here's Ewan with more about it.
As the swallows arriving in our land heralds the coming of summer, the sound of the field fair on our shores marks the official start of winter. As apples fall and rowan trees give forth their annual bounty of red berries, these large, colourful thrushes are a welcome addition to our overwintering wildlife. And they're sociable birds. The sight of flocks of up to 100 strong field fares is one of the great delights of a frosty morning, as they descend from the skies to feast on the apples which litter many a garden. Or even better, the hedges of hawthorn bursting with berries. And they can strip an area quickly, with one report of 5,000 birds descending on a Suffolk orchard to feast on windfalls. The back, a grey pigeon tone, wings the colour of a wren. The plump white of the underbelly highlighted with rows of chevrons, and the throat a delightful shade of custard, and the eye highlighted with a distinctive stripe. The field fare is a beautiful bird, which every year leaves the dwindling food stocks of Northern Europe to seek an easier season in our warmer winter. And that call, known as the herring spear, as thousands of birds crossed the North Sea in darkness, was a welcome sound to fishermen, who viewed it as a bringer of good omen to their nets. The fallow farer, the field fare, after its habits of wandering far and wide. Or in Irish, Sachin, the frost bird. Others suggest the origins in the Anglo-Saxon word fieldwear, which meant traveller of the fields. Even Chaucer, in his 1382 work, The Parliament of Fowls, refers to the frosty field fare, as the birds of the world gathered to choose a mate. That day, the 14th of February, may have in it the origins of the affairs of the heart that became St. Valentine's Day. The field fare, a welcome touch of colour, sound and romance in the Scottish countryside in winter.
See, I like the sound of them, but I've never heard of them described before as the frost bird. I like that.
Yeah, no, some great things. Very quickly, Amanda Stewart's been in touch. Morning, loved your piece on the St Kildians. 40 years ago, as a 16-year-old girl, I was sitting in a classroom. PE had been cancelled, so the teacher was going to give us a talk. Oh no, boring. Wrong. The PE teacher was Lackey Campbell, and his family were from St Kilda. You think his father had been the school teacher. The story they told that day about life on the island and the evacuation transfixed me, and I've never forgotten that day or the story. Sadly, Lackey passed away a few years ago, but fantastic story and well remembered. That's Amanda.
Remember we were in that schoolhouse, because they've done it back
yep,
up again. You can actually go into it and see how, you know, see how the kids would have been taught.
Yeah, it's a real eye-opener, and it's just a lovely place, and we're really privileged because we had, five, 6 days on the island sleeping in one of the houses. It was just tremendous.
Yeah, although admittedly, just for the benefit of other people who might have wanted to sleep, I actually found someone else to sleep. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. Honesty in all things. Don't forget the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is published at noon today. And our midweek podcast published on Wednesday. This is a departure, this, for us, but it was fascinating. It's all about winter woolies and the Scottish wool scene with Louise Scully of the Woolwork podcast. From all of the team here in Aberdeen, thanks for listening. Bye for now.